Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Democrat Dave Lundy, Republican Chris Roebling, and live Decision 2014 reports from North Carolina, Georgia, New Hampshire, Kansas, Iowa, Louisiana, and Illinois. Our program tonight coming to you from our own base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in downtown Chicago. We're less than a block away. 35-year-old Nick Walenda will attempt to tight walk his way across the Chicago River. Hopefully he makes it well and safely. And our toll line, most importantly, our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8209. We want to check our phone lines while Nick Walenda is checking his lines. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. If you'd like to send me an email, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And again, if you want to go to the website, beyondthebeltway.com. We keep all of our past shows, both the audio and video version of those shows for those around the country. We are also a local television show in Chicago. We've got one Republican, one Democrat, lots of reporters from all over the country with you for the next 2 hours. And I would like to begin, first of all, with a sense that at least living in Illinois, which has one of the hotly contested gubernatorial races, and without question, the meanest, nastiest race for governor ever in my lifetime, the negativity of this campaign. Is this campaign more negative than previous campaigns? Was there anything unique about this? Are we moving into an era of only negative advertising, Dave Lundy, our Democrat?
I hesitate to use the word unique. I will use the word unusual. And what I mean by that is the money that flowed into this state, we're nearing $100 million, and my guess is we'll surpass $100 million spent on this race. The incumbent governor is outspent by 2-1. And that's just direct spend. You've got all the outside groups. I don't even know what that tally has been. But it really has been not just stunningly negative, but candidly, neither candidate has a positive message for the future. And it's one of the things that I've found troubling about the governor's pitch, and I found it troubling about the opponent's pitch, and that there just isn't. It's all negative.
Chris Roebling, broadly speaking, would you say that that within the whole broader political world in which we live, that it's been more negative than positive?
Yes.
And is it a trend that's ever going to change?
I think it will change, but I think right now you've got this sixth year of the Obama administration. And so across the country, you've got people who are either critiquing the Obama administration, saying, you've had 6 years, look at what's happened, and here's what's bad about that. So if you vote for my opponent, you're supporting that. And on the other hand, on the Democrat side, since the Democrats, I don't think this year, have done much nationally to talk about what they might consider to be the strong points of their situation. And so instead, they've continued what we saw against Mitt Romney, and that is to make the opponents into the issue and to say these opponents are evil people, when Stephanie Cutter accused Mitt Romney of being a felon.
Yeah. But again, I think the big difference between this season and 2 years ago was, as far as Republicans are concerned, they didn't have candidates out there shooting themselves in the foot. This is a pretty good class of Republican, at least senatorial candidates, which is where our focus will be primarily this evening.
Oh, there's no question. And in fact, as this year, the shoe was on the other foot. Yeah. You famously had a seat that should have been a lock for the Democrats in Iowa, mm-hmm. Succeeding Tom Harkin,
yep.
With Congressman Bruce Braley. And he famously said 2 months ago or 3 months ago, he basically insulted farmers by calling, Chuck Grassley said,
just a farmer.
He's just a farmer. He has no qualifications to be chairman of the Judiciary Committee.
In Montana, you had a Democrat who was appointed, who got into a plagiarism scandal, and that turned into a descending spiral.
Yeah, no, it's for Democrats. This was, we had Schadenfreude last time, and they've got Schadenfreude this time, it's frustrating.
Is it unique that candidates running for the Senate, so many of them as Democrats, are running away from the president? Well, there's not even a handful that want him close by?
That, I think, is unprecedented. I mean, we're seeing here in this last weekend, Air Force One, you know, tooling out to Detroit, then over to Connecticut, and then down to Pennsylvania, and not in Senate races, but in governor races. Right. And so you're looking at maybe Detroit was a Senate race where the guy's so
right,
far
yeah.
ahead. But you're basically looking at incumbent Senate
He's going to
Democrats.
Safe places.
Incumbent Senate Democrats do not want the president. They might take Joe Biden. Michelle Obama is still saleable and still she's working. Hillary Clinton has been really the big name of choice and Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
But the president himself is getting a taste of what George W. Bush went through in 2008 when they didn't even have him at the convention.
Well, and but also it's not remotely unprecedented. The same thing happened in 2006 with George W. Bush, and where George W. Bush, this was post Katrina, the Iraq War was not going well, and so nobody. No Republican wanted George W. Bush. And what I find...
If you were advising a Senate candidate, would you advise that candidate to bring the president in, or is the president only there to help raise money?
I would not advise them to bring the president in, but I would advise them, and I think it is a colossal mistake, and Democrats made the same mistake in 2010. A lot of the policies they could have turned on the Republicans. You saw a little bit of that early on with Obamacare and saying, hey, this Republican is going to take away health care. This Republican is going to take away these services. But it just nobody stuck with it. And they ran. And what happens when you run? This is off year elections are typically base elections. And so if you alienate your base, then you depress your turnout.
I said a couple of months ago that I thought what was happening in Illinois is that this was going to be a test of class warfare because you had a billionaire running on the Republican side. You had a clear populist demagogue, the incumbent, and I say that in a pleasant way.
And you like him.
And I do, and he survived for long time. But my point is, that's what the ads in Illinois have been about. It's been about class warfare. Again, they're going well beyond what they did with Romney, and yet that same tactic doesn't appear to be working in other parts of the United States.
Well, you're right because they don't have there aren't a lot of billionaires running. There are surrogates.
He's a poster child.
He's a poster Browner, child.
Bruce Browner.
The surrogates. There are candidates who are running with some attenuated connection either to George Soros or to the Koch brothers and people on the opposite side. So if you're a Republican and you've got somebody who is connected to Soros, you say that. And if you're a Democrat, you're running against somebody connected to the Koch brothers, you say that. And so that whole Koch-Soros thing, I think, just kind of cancels each other out.
But envy, what about it? What about financial envy? Does it work?
I think that has all been channeled into the Democratic position with respect to so-called minimum wage, which is really their way of breaking up the ground so that they can do so-called immigration reform and bring in a lot of people to depress wages.
Our phone number is 1-800-723-8289 if you'd like to weigh in. When we come back, we're going to start hopscotching around the country, and we're going to start in North Carolina. Don't go away.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. Our first stop tonight on our political jaunt around the country is in North Carolina, where the incumbent Senator Kay Hagan is really viewed, at least initially was viewed as a vulnerable candidate, but she seems to be emerging as one that may survive. Jim Morrell joins us. He's been covering politics in North Carolina for about 30 years for the Charlotte Observer, former member of the Peace Corps, and also went to school at the University of Illinois. Jim, nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway.
Hey, thanks. Nice to be with you.
Set the stage for us in this race. Kay Hagan, again, she was a target at the beginning of the campaign. Take us through the ebb and flow of her campaign and the challenge that she's getting from the Republicans.
Well, she was a target from the get-go. You know, over a year ago, Americans for Prosperity started running ads against her, and you know, this has been the most expensive race in the country. There's been over $100 million spent on the race so far. There's been over 100,000 TV ads, and that was just through last week, so it's probably a lot more even since then. But she's managed to hang on. You know, her opponent is a guy named Tom Tillis. He's a Speaker of the North Carolina House, and he's only been in politics for about 8 years, but he's made a pretty rapid rise, but part of that is that he's been the Speaker of the House during a time when the legislature's made some controversial decisions. Mm-hmm.
So, Jim, this is Chris Roebling up here in Chicago.
Yeah.
Did Kay Hagan, did Senator Hagan succeed in making this race a little bit more about Tom Tillis?
And about North Carolina?
Yeah, I think she did, which is kind of keeping her in the game. Because Tillis, like every other Republican running, is trying to tie Kay Hagan to President Obama, you know, like, you know, to handcuff her to Obama. And, you know, that's what he's got in his favor. Obama's not that popular in North Carolina. He's got about 40% of the vote or 40% approval in the polls. But, you know, this is a state that he won in 2008, and he barely won it in 2008, barely lost it in 2012. So it's a pretty evenly divided state.
Dave Lundy is our Democrat. He's got a question for you, Jim.
What issue was she able to turn on Tillis in terms of what happened in the legislature in North Carolina?
She was trying to turn a lot of things about the legislature. The Republican-controlled legislature passed a voting law that is going to require voter IDs next year, and did a lot of other things involving voting. But the thing that she's been most effective on, I think, has been education. They increased money for education, but not as much as it would take to keep up with the growth. And so, you know, teachers are leaving here in droves. They raise the pay of teachers, but our teachers are still underpaid compared to the average of the country.
Wasn't she one of the first to also speak out and question the wisdom of the CDC and the president's handling of the Ebola situation?
I don't know if she was one of the first. She may have been one of the first Democrats. Tillis, right. Actually, I think, criticized Obama's handling of that first.
I meant as a Democrat.
She came in a couple days later. Yeah, so she was in that. She's kind of walked a fine line. I mean, she's tried to distance herself from the president, no doubt.
What are the positions that she is more conservative on than, let's say, the National Democratic Party, that makes her, someone that maybe independents and some Republicans could live with?
Well, she got she got ranked as the most moderate senator by the National Journal in their most recent rankings. I think she's more conservative on some, you know, they rank on foreign policy issues and on economic issues. And I think generally, She's not considered a liberal Democrat by any means, except in the ads that you see from the Republicans. But nobody would call her a liberal, except, you know, that she supported President Obama 96% of the time.
Exactly. I mean, Jim, I mean, yeah. The point, it's not who she is, it's what she does. And what she does is 96% of the time vote with Obama. Now, that's for North Carolina voters to decide. But let me ask you this question. What is the ground game sort of sense that you're getting down there? Who is better at getting their vote out, with the state having been so close over the last few years?
I think Democrats have always been better at it, at least recently. You know, the Obama machine is still in operation down here. Take a look at the early voting totals. Early voting down here ended yesterday. Democrats, measuring this against 2010, which was the last comparable off-year election, Democrats increased their early vote 120% over that year. Republicans also increased it, but not nearly as much. So Democrats had their turnout machine working, and it's not just Democrats and not just Republicans, but on the Republican side, you've got American for Prosperity, which has field organizers down here. Everybody's getting into the turnout game. Planned Parenthood for the other side. So everybody's doing it, and apparently they're doing a better job.
Dave Lundy.
I'm wondering, how did she play the President Obama question? Because we saw in Kentucky where Alison Grimes, you know, just refused to answer whether she even voted for him, where other states, they handled it more deftly. I'm wondering how she managed to kind of walk that tightrope.
I don't know if she did it very deftly, to be honest with you. Nobody asked her who she voted for, but they did ask her whether she thought Obama was a strong leader. And it's kind of painful to watch that interview, to be honest with you. It was a broadcast on MSNBC a week or two ago, and there's not really a good answer from her in there. And somebody else asked her a similar question about Obama's leadership, and she just didn't sound all that straightforward.
Well, from afar, Jim, I wanted to kind of just broaden the discussion for just a second. For those listening around the country, obviously they're concerned about what's going to happen on Tuesday, but they're also looking ahead to 2016. And you mentioned that the Democrats have been successful in North Carolina for a couple of presidential elections. What is the changing demographic of that state that has moved it from a Republican state, let's say 10 years ago, to maybe a swing Republican or a swing Southern state now?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, Obama in 2008 was the first Democratic presidential candidate to carry the state since Jimmy Carter. So it was a pretty red state. But what's happening is, you know, demographics. I mean, a lot of people are moving into North Carolina from the Northeast. A lot of African Americans are moving back south. So your population centers, your cities like Charlotte and Raleigh and Winston-Salem and Greensboro are getting more blue. The suburbs are getting redder, and the rural areas are still generally conservative. But, you know, you've got a great population shift. I mean, some of the cities in North Carolina are some of the fastest growing cities in the country, like Raleigh and Charlotte.
So do you project then that in 2016, North Carolina probably will be in the top 10 list of states that are swing states for both parties?
I think so, and as a reporter, I hope so. you know, it's made a lot of difference. You know, we've seen a lot of the surrogates who've come in here this year for Tom Tillis especially, and to a lesser degree for Hagan, are 2016 possibles. You know, gosh, Mitt Romney was in here just last week, and Rand Paul's been in here. So, you know, people, I think, see it as a swing state now.
Well, Go ahead, Chris Roebling.
I want to ask about kind of the other side of David's question. David asked you about, you know, what issue was Kay Hagan able to use against Tillis. What issues for Tillis sort of got him to where he is? Because this is his first statewide race. What has he been talking about? What seems to be responsive in the populace to Tillis's campaign?
Well, I'll tell you, 90% of the commercials on his side, you know, from his campaign and from his allies have been trying to tie her to Obama. 96% of the time she's voted with him. But, you know, I think a pretty telling attack in the last month has been her record on the Senate Armed Services Committee. She had missed some of the hearings of the committee, and you know how many depends on who you talk to, but she missed one notoriously in February when she attended a fundraiser. Now she said that the hearing, it was a closed hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee, which, you know, kind of got scheduled and rescheduled and rescheduled again, and when it finally happened, she had to miss it for a fundraiser.
Jim, on the Sunday show,
it was a hearing about
on the Sunday morning shows on both at least the ABC and NBC, the thought today as they were kicking around this race, they basically thought that Kay Hagan was going to survive and that everything was flowing in the Democratic column and that this was going to be one that the Democrats are going to keep. As the man who has your feet on the ground in Charlotte, North Carolina, would you agree with that assessment from the National Observers this morning?
You know, I think it could go either way. I think Hagan had it, not comfortably, but I think she was in control until the last week or two, and I think she's lost some ground. There were a couple fairly credible polls that came out just last week that showed a dead heat, not even within the margin of error, but just a dead heat.
Dave Lundy, one last question.
So on election night, what are the early markers that you're looking at that folks around the country can look to say, hey, which way is this particular race blowing?
30 seconds, Jim.
Well, that's a good question. I think it's how many votes she comes out of in some of the urban areas. She needs a big margin in the urban areas, and Tillis, conversely, needs a big margin in the suburbs.
Okay. Jim, thanks very much. A veteran political reporter for the Charlotte Observer in Charlotte, North Carolina, talking about the race for the United States Senate down there, one of the key races. Republicans are looking for six seats, six pickups, and that's one they would like to have. I'm Bruce Dumont. When we come back, we're going to head further south to Georgia.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton Los Angeles Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
Back in Chicago. Thank you very much. From coast to coast and border to border, this is Taking America's Political Pulse this evening. And again, just a couple of days away from big election day throughout the country. Alan Abramovich joins us now. He joins us from Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia, where he is a professor at Emory University. And Alan, thank you very much for being with us on Beyond the Beltway.
Sure, glad to be with you.
For many years, it was an automatic thing. Every couple of 3-4 years, you would vote for a nun down there.
And not a Catholic one.
It was a habit. Voting for a nun. And obviously, this morning, again, on the Sunday morning programs, as they were analyzing the hot races, they thought that Nunn, the Democrat, the daughter of Sam Nunn, had an edge. Michelle Nunn had an edge over David Perdue in the U.S. Senate race. Do you agree with that assessment? At this moment in time, does she have the edge?
Well, it's clearly a very close race. My assessment, based on all the polling that we've seen and the trends in that polling over the past couple of weeks, is that David Perdue probably has a small lead at this point. It's not certain because, the polls have been variable. But the indications are that Perdue probably has a small lead, but it may not be large enough to avoid a runoff.
Professor, this is Chris Roebling. So can you tell us how the great state of Georgia operates this runoff system and when it would all be resolved?
Right. Yeah, it's a very unusual situation here. Georgia is one of only two states, along with Louisiana, that has a runoff election in the general election, although Louisiana's election is actually a primary. But we have a general election runoff if no candidate gets the majority of the vote. So in the case of the Senate race, the runoff election would actually be on January 6th, which is 2 months after the general election, a very long wait. The runoffs for state offices would be in early December, but the federal offices would have runoffs in January.
So this is Dave Lundy. So effectively what you're saying is that if control of the U.S. Senate comes down to Georgia, or probably Georgia and Louisiana, if it's that close, which I'm not sure
right.
it will be, we've got two more months of absolutely no holds barred, every dollar in the entire country pouring into two races, one of which is yours. What
right.
does it look like in a general election down or in a runoff? Because I've heard a lot about Louisiana. I haven't actually heard polling of how she stacks up in a one-on-one.
Yeah. Well, that's because there hasn't been a lot of polling here on what a runoff would look like, because you know, there's a lot of uncertainty about what the turnout would be in such a runoff. If control of the U.S. Senate is actually at stake in the Georgia runoff, I think we could expect to see some very, very intense campaigning and a lot of money, you know, being spent on the campaign. And, you know, it's possible that the turnout in the runoff would be close to or even higher than the turnout in the first election. Normally, you get a pretty big drop in turnout when you go to a runoff because there aren't as many, you know, races on the ballot, and you know it's just being held by itself.
What is Michelle Nunn saying that is keeping her so close, or possibly even the lead in this race, or is it
right.
just about her name?
Well, I think it's partly about her name and about the Sam Nunn. Sam Nunn's reputation in this state, even though it's been a long time since he was serving in the Senate from the state of Georgia, but there's still a lot of folks here who remember him very fondly. But the other things that are helping her, I think, are, you know, that she's running as a centrist Democrat in the mold of Sam Nunn, that she's been able to raise a large amount of money, I think about $14 million so far, and that's, you know, that's certainly helping to keep her in the race. And that I think that Democrats have found some vulnerabilities to exploit with the Republican nominee here, David Perdue.
Now, on the Sunday morning shows, they were also talking about a pamphlet that is being distributed throughout the state that is bringing up race and referring to the situation in Missouri, suggesting that certainly playing and fanning a racial card. What can you tell us about that? Who has distributed it, and what has been the response to it?
And has Michelle Nunn disavowed it?
Yep.
Well, from what I've heard, she hasn't exactly disavowed it. I mean, when she was asked about this in a debate recently with David Perdue, she sort of changed the subject and talked about the importance of voting and getting a maximum turnout and everyone turning out to vote. This was a Democratic Party pamphlet, flyer. And, you know, it's certainly controversial that the point that what they're trying to accomplish here is to energize the African-American electorate. And, you know, I would have to say it's I don't know if this is responsible for it, but we're seeing a very strong turnout so far among African-American voters in the early voting. We have statistics already on the makeup of the early voters here in Georgia, and almost one-third of the early voters are African-American, and it's now expected that African-Americans will end up making up about 30% of the final vote total here, which is very good for a midterm election.
Are newspapers responding to this controversial flyer in any way? Is it being viewed as either dirty politics or as race baiting?
I haven't really seen that much commentary on it in the press, to tell you the truth. I mean, I think mainly it's being brought up, you know, by Republican leaders and candidates and trying.
And
you know,
national media as well.
And some national media, yeah. But I don't actually think it's going to have that much impact here in Georgia.
Dave Lundy is our Democrat. Alan, he's got a comment for you.
A couple of quick things. One, you said you expect African-Americans to be 30% of the vote. What percentage
right.
of they are of the population and of the vote typically?
Well, typically in recent elections, they've been about 29 to 30% of the vote in presidential elections, but less than that in midterm elections. In 2010, I think African-Americans were about 26% or so, or maybe 27% of the vote. It's been rising. The African-American share of the electorate here has increased quite a bit over the last, 10 to 20 years. We've also got a growing Latino population here, but it's, it makes up a pretty small share of the electorate, maybe 3 or 4 or 5%.
Now, Michelle Nunn is not the only famous name that's on the ballot down there. The grandson of Jimmy Carter, the former governor and president, he's running for governor. Tell us
a little bit
about that race and where does he stand at the moment?
Well, again, it's a fairly close race. And again, the polls, differ somewhat in the relative standing of the candidates. Most of the recent polling on the governor's race has showed Nathan Deal, the incumbent Republican governor, with a slight lead, usually on the magnitude of, 2 to 4 percentage points, sometimes 5 or 6, on average, probably about 3 or 4. So, if that's accurate, he has a little bit bigger lead right now than David Perdue does, according to the polling. He has a better chance to avoid a runoff, I think. But there's still a chance that race could go to a runoff, but that one would be in December.
Just by the way, Professor, to fill in the other part of this runoff situation, are there third parties? What would cause one of these candidates, or what would cause neither of the two major party candidates to get 50% plus one?
Right. Well, the reason would be that we have libertarian candidates in both races, and we typically have libertarian candidates running in our elections for governor and U.S. Senate in recent years. And they typically get between 2 and 3% of the vote, sometimes a little more than 3, sometimes a little less than 2. So, a lot will depend on how large the libertarian vote is and whether in the end voters who are thinking of voting libertarian decide instead to vote for one of the two major party candidates because the race is so close. So, that's what's potentially causing a runoff election here.
Are there games being played on that vote? What I mean by that is, here in Illinois, there's been a big effort on Democrats and unions to support the libertarian because he's pro-life, and the perception is that he would take away from the Republican candidate for governor who's pro-choice. Do you have similar dynamics playing out either in the Senate or the governor's race down there?
No, I haven't seen much evidence here that either major party is pushing people to vote for the libertarian. I think, typically you would think that most libertarian voters would tend to vote Republican in a straight-up contest between a Democrat and a Republican. But what we've seen in some of the polling is that when voters are asked about a choice between Nunn and Perdue, for example, that they tend to split pretty evenly. So it's not clear exactly what the libertarian vote is here, if it's a protest vote or if it's really a vote for libertarian principles.
Professor Abramovitz, you have a remarkable record. You're one of the leading forecasters of elections. You've been dead on from 1988 to 2012 at the presidential level. You want to put your reputation on the line and pick a winner in that U.S. Senate race down there?
Well, I think the most likely outcome right now is going to be a runoff in the Senate race. Ultimately, I think in the end, David Perdue probably wins the runoff, but I wouldn't bet a lot of money on that. In the governor's race, I think that Nathan Deal may be able to pull this off without a runoff, but again, I wouldn't bet too much on that either. These are just such close races that there's quite a bit of uncertainty here in how this is going to turn out. So, I think we're just going to have to wait for the returns to come in.
We will do that. Alan Abramovitz from Emory University for joining us. And I guess it's going to be a great time to own radio and television stations in Georgia. They're going to rake it in. Back shortly from Chicago, and we're going to head to New Hampshire.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for being with us. We're taking America's political pulse from coast to coast and border to border. We do it every week, but tonight we're specifically going to specific regions of the country where some of the major U.S. Senate races are still up for grabs. And again, the Republicans are looking for six seats. We've talked about a couple of Democrats, one Democrat that looks like she may survive, but although clearly our reporter Jim Morrell from the Charlotte Observer did not fall lockstep with the Washington, D.C. pundits today that suggested that Kay Hagan was going to make it for re-election. Let's introduce our guest. Dave Lundy is with us. Dave, tell us a little bit about your background and where you're going to be election night, because people will be able to hear your dulcet tones elsewhere.
Well, thank you, Bruce. I'm president of a company called Aileron Communications. We're a communications and public affairs strategy firm focusing mostly on the innovation space. My background, I've worked campaigns. I'm a recovering lawyer, on election night, I'll be on a different radio station. Can I say which
you
one?
You can.
I will be on WBEZ.
It's a public radio station.
Public radio in Chicago, breaking down the race.
And Chris Roebling also joins us. Tell us a little bit about your background and where you're going to be election night.
Well, I'm very proud to say that I've been associated with this radio program for many years and former executive director of the Cook County Republican Party. I work with Clearspan Strategic LLC, which is my own company, and kind of like David. And on Tuesday night, I'll be on WGN TV Channel 9 here in Chicago.
And Superstation.
It is a superstation, but I don't know if they put their election coverage up.
I
hope
so.
Yeah.
I mean, you should be all over the place.
Yeah.
Well, they will know where to find you. And again, one of the races that has been closely watched, which is historic in that it pits the incumbent Senator Jean Shaheen, the Democrat in New Hampshire, against Scott Brown, who once upon a time was a U.S. senator from Massachusetts, then lost Ellen Warren, and then he moved to his summer home in New Hampshire and is going to run and would be the second person in U.S. history other than Daniel Webster to represent two states in the United States Senate if he is successful. Ben Sorrow joins us. He is a talk show host on WNTK, the oldest affiliate of this program, and also WUVR radio. He's on every single morning covering central New Hampshire and also Vermont. And Ben, nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway.
Oh, Bruce, thank you so much. And I have to say, it's a little different to be broadcasting at 7:45 at night instead of in the morning. So if I sound a little spotty, it's past my bedtime.
Well, listen, it's great to have you with us. You're joining us live from New London, New Hampshire, and that's just a stone's throw from Dartmouth College. My question to you at this particular moment, again, I'm sort of following up on what all the Sunday pundits basically said today. They also thought that New Hampshire was one of those states where the Democrat Senator Jean Shaheen would hang on. Would you see it that way at this moment? Because you're actually on the ground there.
Yeah, I hate to be so vague with you, Bruce. I think it's really going to come down to turnout. And I got to tell you, I'm with the pollsters who are saying it's dead even. We have seen some polling data that shows that Shaheen has a significant lead. I've also seen where Brown has a slight lead. But from what I'm hearing and talking to people, it is pretty much split down the middle. I'll tell you, I can't draw much of a conclusion.
Now, you are going to have both candidates on your radio show tomorrow, are you not?
I will have Scott Brown tomorrow. Actually, Jean Shaheen has kind of taken a back step with local small radio stations. She hasn't done a lot of local small radio, especially mm-hmm. talk radio, and it's been very tough to book her. Now, I want to be very clear. She hasn't said no to coming on, but she hasn't said yes either.
Okay. And in that particular state, at least observing from the outside, the fact that Scott Brown was the United States Senator from Massachusetts, and this was his second home, How has that played? Has the carpetbagger issue dogged him, or is much of that state carpetbaggers?
You know, it's funny when you say much of that state. New Hampshire does have a population. It's about 65% from away, as the locals will say. The carpetbagger issue is a tough one because I think for the Democrats, they've really pushed it. At the same time, the Republicans haven't really defended it, but it is an issue for him with, I would say, a lot of people a little further to the right have said, this is a real issue. This guy isn't one of us. His response has been that he was born at the Naval Yard in Portsmouth, and that, you know, he grew up here and then moved away. So I don't know how big a role it plays. I think it's one of those ancillary issues that, you know, people tend to focus on when we have a lot more bigger issues in the state.
Now, Jeanne Shaheen, talking about, you know, whether or not she'll be on your program. Jeanne Shaheen was a guest on this program when we began our association with WNTK back in 1992. Mm-hmm. She wasn't even elected then. She's been elected governor and now a United States Senator, and the Shaheen name is certainly well known. So my question to you is, why is she still on the ropes potentially in this race?
You know, it's funny you bring that up because I think that for the most part, she's not, I don't want to say a bad word here. She's not hated. It's not a situation where people don't like her. She has some level of popularity. I think with independents, though, in a year where the president is polling pretty low, and by his own admission, this election is about his initiatives and his performance, that's why she's dragging down.
We got a quick question from our Democrats. Got a quick question for him. We've got a minute to answer.
Just wondering what the turning point in the race for Scott Brown was, because early on he was having some troubles, and then suddenly he seemed to come back. What was that?
I think a lot of it had to do with energy rates going up 47%. I would say that unemployment numbers being hit pretty hard in the state. And then I think some of things like Ebola, the Middle East, things like that. I think that he was very good at being able to get people to rally around his message, which is jobs, the economy, immigration.
Ben Saro, we're going to have to go. WNTK in New London, New Hampshire, has joined us with an update on the Granite State. And again, that will be one of the first races to be called on Tuesday night. So we'll know at least perhaps the beginning of a trend could be on election night. For those of you listening from coast to coast on radio, we're going to be back for another full hour with more states, including Kansas and Iowa, coming up in the next hour. If you're watching us on television, we're going to see you next Sunday night, and we'll have the answers to all these questions about campaign and decision 2014. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly on radio. See you next week on TV. To some of the major races that are still up for grabs, there's about 12 Senate seats that are debatable at this particular moment. The Republicans need to pick up 6 of those seats. One place where they think they can do that is in Iowa, where the retiring Democrat Tom Harkin is not seeking another term. And U.S. Representative Bruce Braley is running against the GOP State Senator Jody Ernst. And joining us to talk about what's happening in the Hawkeye State is O.K. Henderson, and she is the news director of Radio Iowa. She's been a guest on this program. She was a guest on the major network shows this morning. And, O.K., nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway.
Hello.
Nice to have you with us. Every couple of years,
we're
doing this show,
exactly.
And we'll be heading to Iowa shortly after this campaign ends.
We'll be there Wednesday morning.
That's right.
Because
it's going to be all about 2016 at that point. At this particular moment, again, I've been quoting what some of the Sunday morning shows were saying, including shows that you were on, basically that because of recent polling by the Des Moines Register, which is one of the most reliable newspaper polls in the country, they are now giving the edge to Jody Ernst, and most of the D.C. insiders thinking that that she's probably going to hang on. Do you see it that way?
It appears to be that way on the ground. There is momentum for her. It's the same kind of momentum she had in a 5-way primary. When Tom Harkin announced that he was going to retire in 2013, there were a host of Republican luminaries in Iowa who thought about running for the seat, sitting members of Congress, They tried to get, you know, Governor Branstad to even consider running for this. They all said no. And so you had five sort of no-name, nobody knew who they were, Republicans who were running for this seat. And then in March, Joni Ernst ran an ad talking about her farm roots and her ability to castrate pigs. And that catapulted her ahead of the pack. And at the end of the primary in June, she really raced to the head of the pack. She won it handily. And people on the ground say it sort of feels like that same thing. The one caveat is Democrats in 2012 ran an excellent ground game here on behalf of President Obama. They have replicated it this year. So that is the one avenue that Bruce Braley might have to keep this thing close.
Dave Lundy is our Democrat. He's got a comment for you.
I'm wondering, was Braley ever able to recover from his just, I don't know a better word than idiotic, slip on the farm comment with Grassley?
It
struck me at that moment that the race was close to over. And it felt very much like, you know, what the Republicans went through with, you know, Todd Akin and so on back in 2012.
Right.
Or George Allen in Virginia.
Or George Allen in
Stupid.
It was his macaca moment. He never had a good explanation about why he would say something like that to his colleagues, his fellow trial lawyers, behind closed doors when he would say something different in public. It undercut his message. He was never seen by voters as someone genuine. If you look at the polling data in the Des Moines Register poll, which you mentioned, the thing that's fascinating about it is the poll that they did this past week and the poll they did the week before. It shows that Braley lines up with Iowa voters in terms of the issues, but they just don't like him. And he was never able to recover and become sort of a genuine article with people, someone that they thought they could, you know, entrust their vote with.
And it
was really damaging.
One of the things, okay, that I think is going to start instantly again on Wednesday morning of this coming week, and it will probably dominate some of the early analysis of campaign 2014, is the impact. There's been a lot said that Obama has not been out there campaigning in the Senate races. But again, on the other side, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton have been all over. They have been to Iowa at least a couple of times in this race as well.
Right.
So assessing the impact of where they went and whether or not they made a difference, I think is going to be one of the interesting things to analyze. And in this particular case, the Clintons don't seem to have done enough to help Braley survive.
Well, the one thing I will say about William Jefferson Clinton's appearance here in Des Moines on Saturday afternoon, which ironically was three blocks away from the Obama 08 headquarters and three blocks away from Obama's last campaign rally of 2012, he didn't show himself in Iowa in a public way. But Clinton was able to, for the first time in 7 months, actually respond to that ad that I mentioned. Braley was never able to craft a response to the castration ad. Clinton offered
What did Bill Clinton say about castration? I'm very interested in this.
Actually, it was fascinating. Clinton came out and he said, you know, I liked that ad. She's an attractive candidate. You know, she's a better shot than I am, because she also ran another ad in which she took target practice, and they showed her target practice. Mm-hmm. But he said, and in terms of her promise in that ad to go to Washington to cut pork, she's and make him squeal is the actual thing that she said. Mm-hmm. Clinton said the important thing is when you're cutting, you have to know the difference between pork and people. He was the first person to actually put it in cogent terms like that mm-hmm. voters can actually understand. Braley was never able to articulate it in that way.
Well, I mean, that's why he's Bill Clinton. And I guess
I guess
I want to bring in Harry Reid, and I want to ask you if Harry Reid's comment, which might strike people as closing the barn door after all of the hogs have left, his comment that if we lose Iowa, we lose the Senate,
we're done.
Is that actually a strategic comment to get the Iowa Democrats off their rear ends to try and generate turnout for Braley, notwithstanding his inability to be Bill Clinton?
Or might it backfire?
Well, the folks that Harry Reid was talking to are folks that are energized by Elizabeth Warren. She actually talked to the same group of people by phone a couple of hours after Harry Reid did. Elizabeth Warren came to Iowa a couple of weekends ago, and she lit a prairie fire here. People really are engaged in her as a progressive voice for the party, and she brought people out that I hadn't seen for Braley before. I think Reid was speaking to a core of the party that he wanted to, you know, express to them, you know, the urgency of this mission here in Iowa. I don't think you have to convince the Democratic faithful here in Iowa that this is a critical race. The problem they're having is convincing voters who aren't traditional midterm voters to actually cast a ballot this time.
Has every potential Republican candidate for president shown up there to speak for Jody Ernst and obviously speak for themselves as well? But have they all showed up to help her across the goal line?
Marco Rubio was here in the past week. John McCain, by the way, I don't think he's running again. He was here.
You never know.
Ted Cruz did some private events for her. He has not campaigned here in the last week. Jeb Bush had a fundraiser in Florida for her. Ironically, Chris Christie has been here three times in October, but he's not campaigning for Joni Ernst. He's campaigning for Terry Branstad, Iowa's governor, who, by the way, in the Iowa poll was shown to be 24 points ahead of his Democratic challenger.
The most prodigious vote-getter in the history of the state.
Joni, by the way, had a
Chuck Grassley.
Behind Grassley. Okay, that's interesting.
Joni Ernst had a terrific fundraiser here in Chicago 14 days ago. She was out, and people are coming. People are you know, elbowing each other to get into her fundraisers because of that ad. And because it's not just the ad. You have to say that this is a candidate who she's genuine. She is who she says she is. And she's got that national security background, having served in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So she really is resonating what she has to say, whether it's about agriculture, whether it's about international relations, which is a part of the Senate portfolio, or whether it's about, you know, just fiscal issues. She really comes across as the real deal.
She's a national player if she's elected, I think.
No question. One question.
And the other thing about her is the outside groups that have spent, I hope you're both sitting down, $62 million on this race.
In Iowa?
In Iowa. Boy, you ought to give Iowa a try, right, Meredith Wilson?
Exactly. Yeah, $62 million. That's not counting the campaigns. This thing probably, when we're done, is probably going to approach $100 million in spending for just one race.
So
her is all of those ads that have run against her, they've been calling her an extremist, the outside groups. You have Planned Parenthood who've run a lot of ads about her on the same message that they're focusing in Colorado. The thing about it is, as a commander of troops, And as someone who talks about their firm roots, that extremist label has just slid off her. She is a Teflon candidate because of her personality, right. And she stars in her own ads.
I think you, earlier in the interview, I think you summarized the essence of really every candidate or every campaign when you said that Bruce Braley is just not liked and Jody Ernst is liked. And people don't vote for people they don't like. They may agree with them on all the issues, but if they don't like them, they're not going to vote for them. Listen, okay, Henderson, thank you very much for being with us. Again, you're part of our campaign tradition here on Beyond the Beltway, and I look forward to seeing you in the great state of Iowa as we head for 2016. Nice to have you with us tonight.
Bruce Dumont, great to talk to you guys.
Back shortly from Chicago.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida, so why not experience it as it was meant to be, where turquoise gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Back in Chicago, our last stop on our political hopscotch across America is in the great state of Louisiana, and our guest is Cole Avery. He is a legislative and state political reporter for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Times-Picayune, one of the and Times-Picayune.com as well. And Cole, thanks very much for being with us. We have heard earlier in the broadcast that Louisiana, once again, with its unusual of election and campaign season down there, it may not be over on Tuesday night. Explain why.
That's right, and thank you for having me. Everybody in Louisiana, of course, runs at the same time. The top two vote-getters, regardless of party, go on to the runoff if nobody gets 50% plus one. And so things are shaping up to be a runoff between Senator Landrieu and Representative Cassidy. The Landrieu people, they claim that they can win Tuesday. They see a path to get there. And I feel like momentum has probably shifted a little in their direction, but I'm not sure it's been enough to get them to that mark to avoid the runoff. So I guess we'll see, though.
Mary Landrieu got herself in at least on the front pages of some papers and in the news when she recently made a comment about President Obama and African Americans and whether or not he might have been not given a fair shake because he's African American. Now, I have summarized her comments. You may want to be a little more specific about that. But has it created any kind of a problem for her in Louisiana?
Yeah, I'm not sure. The full context of her comments, they came at the end of her explaining that President Obama is unpopular in Louisiana mostly because of his energy policy, which Senator Landrieu actually opposes. And then, of course, tacked on me, but it has been more difficult for him because he's African American. And that made a lot of Republicans upset. But the truth is that, I mean, she's right. The idea that racism in the South no longer exists is just absolutely false. But I do think she's right that most people are probably upset with him because of his policies and less because of his race. But there's certainly a racial component for some people.
Was this now? Oh, come on now. You're talking to Chicago, and we're going to talk plainly. This was an explicit attempt on her part to explain away Obama unpopularity in a state he won, right?
He lost Louisiana.
He lost Louisiana twice or once?
Twice.
All right.
Twice. No, look, she was asked to
The last Democrat was President Clinton back in 1996.
By the way, just to be clear, here's what you said. Quote, "I'll be very, very honest with you. The South has not always been the friendliest place for African Americans. It's been a difficult time for the president to present himself in a very positive light as a leader." End of quote. That's what she said in an interview with Chuck Todd. And some are viewing that as
that's playing the race card. She is resorting to a racial explanation to explain away the fact that the guy has terrible unpopularity today because of things like XL, the Keystone XL pipeline, and his energy policy and the failure of his economic policies.
My friend Chris may be the only one who's looking at that comment, which was a very honest, very direct comment that was completely true, as Cole is understands it from witnessing what's going on in Louisiana. There's racism in Louisiana. This is not news.
Joe Scarborough said that he was surprised that she made the comment, though.
It was surprising. And could you make the argument she was playing with the race card? Absolutely. But to be fair, that's only a portion of what she actually said. And if you ask her, and she reiterated it later, most people are upset with President Obama in Louisiana because of his energy policy. And I would go further than that. I think a lot of people are upset with him over the Affordable Care Act as well. But I think those are playing a larger role in people's dislike for the president than his race. But for some people, and I've met and talked to some of these people, it is because of his race.
Tell us about the Republican candidate, Bill Cassidy. And where is his strength coming from, and what is keeping him from getting to that 50% mark, in your view?
His strength is coming from dislike for the president. His sole campaign has been about the president's policies and Senate Majority Leader Reid. His argument is that even if Senator Landrieu is opposed to energy policy, there's not a whole lot she can do about it because Senator Reid isn't allowing votes on some of these issues. What's keeping him from getting to 50% is the Tea Party favorite, Colonel Rob Manus. He's pulling enough support that's going to keep Cassidy from hitting the 50% mark. How much remains to be seen. The highest I've seen him in legitimate polling has been 15%, but most have him around 10.
If someone does not get to 50%, like in Georgia, which we talked about Georgia earlier in the broadcast, if you don't get to 50%, there's going to be a runoff. When would that take place at Louisiana?
December the 6th.
So
another month.
The runoff in Louisiana would be before the runoff in Georgia.
Correct.
We would not know who is in control of the U.S. Senate because of the election laws in those two states.
So this is the top two face each other regardless of party. Here we'd be talking about the Republican and the Democrat. And what's the record on what is your early voting indicating?
The early voting is higher than usual, and it's especially high in Orleans Parish, which could be a good sign for Senator Landrieu. But there has not been a significant bump in African American turnout, which I know the Landrieu people were hoping for. It's been on par with previous elections, the exception of 2008. There's been a good number coming
out. So you say
early.
That you say that she's been worried about the African American turnout?
Oh, they're critical to her reelection.
Well, her comments certainly would suggest that those comments and the reaction to those comments could be viewed favorably by African Americans. That this could be another example where, whether you call it the race card or not, bringing up the issue of race, could play to her favor.
Sure, that's a good point.
Because what she said the South has not always been the friendliest place for African Americans. I don't think there's too many people that would disagree with that. However, if you're looking at historically, it is not just Republicans that have made the South uncomfortable for African Americans. For well over 100 years, when the Democrats were the solid South, they did not make things easy for African Americans either. And certainly, senators from Louisiana and Georgia were leaders of that movement.
Sure, and I mean,
Abraham Lincoln was a Republican. So, it goes back a long way. Arguably the dynamics began their shift in the South, where everybody was a Democrat, began shifting because of President Johnson, a Democrat, embracing the Civil Rights Act. So,
Cole, we don't know how obviously it's going to end. We will wait until the voters decide. But what is it about Mary Landrieu? They call her Landslide Landrieu because I don't think she's ever won an election by a significant number. What is it about her that keeps her so close, and the voters of Louisiana keep electing her, even by a minuscule amount, as was the case 6 years ago?
It's hard for Democrats to win statewide elected positions. She is the last Democrat to do so. I think that has something to do with it. If you go back in 2008, she had a lot of help because of high turnout for people and wanting to vote for President Obama. She has been telling people that her toughest race was the first one, where she only won by about 5,600 votes.
What's Governor Jindal doing in this race? How much of his
absolutely
power and influence?
Nothing.
Nothing.
He's doing absolutely nothing. He's other than when he's in other states campaigning for other candidates and perhaps for himself. He takes some shots at Senator Landrieu, but he hasn't been doing anything for Bill Cassidy. He hasn't been doing anything
for
Rob Manis.
How come?
I don't think they want him to. He's very unpopular in the state of Louisiana, and I don't think that Cassidy or Manis want him around.
So they don't want him around, like Mary Landrieu may not want the president around.
Exactly.
So it's going to come down to the personalities.
Yes, and in fact,
but if it goes, we've only got about 15 seconds left. If it goes to a runoff because of Rob Manis, the Tea Party Republican, does it not give the edge to Cassidy in a runoff?
I think so. It's going to be very hard for Senator Landrieu to win in a runoff.
Okay, Cole Avery, thanks very much for joining us, political reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. And when we come back, we will be discussing and wrapping up campaign 2014, talking about another hot race, which we've avoided for our national audience, and that's the governorship of Illinois. Back in Chicago, and before we go run out of time, we're going to talk briefly about Illinois governorship race, but pick off, you think that the Republicans are going to pick up more than six seats, Chris Roebling?
I am very cautious about this, but I think the Republicans end up with Montana, South Dakota, West Virginia, Arkansas, Colorado, Alaska, and Iowa. That is seven pickups, and that would give the Senate to the Republicans.
Cautious. Where will they lose? Where will they lose?
Well,
where will they lose a seat?
Oh, I think Kansas is looking like
Kansas.
A potential. Yeah.
Okay. How do you see? Do you agree or disagree with his magnificent seven pickups for the Republicans?
I unfortunately largely agree. I've been watching and waiting because there's been so much uncertainty on the Senate side this year. Because for every time you saw a candidate like Bruce Braley, who you thought was done for, then all of a sudden he came back and then was gone and then back. So there didn't seem to be any texture to this, but in the last week, this swath of polls from around the country showed the movement towards the Republicans. So
Mitch McConnell in Kentucky being a part of that big.
I thought that was gone a long time ago, but Iowa, Colorado,
yes.
Arkansas. He was winning most of the year. Pryor was winning most of the year, and now he's down by convincingly 7 points. This Ernst thing in Iowa, I think.
Alaska.
Yeah.
10 polls since August, and 9 of them for the Republicans.
Yeah, I think it's probably seven seats.
So you agree that the Republicans will gain control of the United States Senate? We'll talk about it next Sunday night on their broadcast. But again, with 2016 just a couple of years away, governorships become very important. Let's talk about the Illinois governorship race. The incumbent Democrat Pat Quinn running against a moderate Republican, Bruce Rauner, the most expensive, the most bitter campaign in Illinois history. Again, a quick 15 seconds on it, Chris.
Well, I think the Rauner campaign is now seen as having made a strategic error by not telling a Rauner story and not elaborating a Rauner program. So the Rauner campaign has basically been saying, I am not Quinn. The Quinn program has been saying things are getting better. And it looks right now, it's way too close. Things in Illinois are so bad, Rauner should be well ahead. He's not.
Well, in the Quinn program, I agree with Chris, but the Quinn program has also been to say, this is not a guy you can trust. They've pointed to his business dealings. They've talked about story after story after story after story after story on companies that he's owned. Some of it is true, some of it's not, but it doesn't matter. The overall picture is very, very ugly. But just let me say one other quick thing. I think that Rauner's biggest strategic mistake occurred in May. Everybody expected him to open the checkbook, write a humongous check, and start attacking the governor starting in May and never let up, and he didn't do it.
Speaking of attacking governors and targeting him, probably the top targeted Republican governor in the United States at the beginning of this cycle was Scott Walker in Wisconsin, and according to what they said on the morning shows, he may be pulling away in that race.
Scott Walker is going to win on Tuesday, and he will be a terrific candidate for president.
Dave Lundy?
Scott Walker is going to win on Tuesday, and he will be a scary candidate for president.
Rick Scott in Florida. Again, Charlie Crist, the once-upon-time Republican, now Democrat. That one's really close. That one will get a lot of play because of the importance of the Florida primary in 2016.
Fangate. Rick Scott is going to lose that election, and if he loses it by a half a point, he has nobody but himself to blame for that stupid thing he did with the fan.
I think Scott comes through by tenths of a percent.
Tenths of a percent.
There's only like 0.3.
Well, but that's in Florida, that's a landslide.
If you can measure it in more than triple digits, it's a huge victory for
Scott. Is there any other big surprise you expect on election night? Dave Lundy.
You know, I mean, I think the big surprise on election night is that, like 2006, most of these close races are going to go the Republicans' way. I'm not sure that's a huge surprise, but I think that's going to happen.
Two quick things. I think there are going to be some extraordinary House takeaways, probably both sides.
Give me two or four.
Well, I think Bob Dold is going to beat Brad Schneider on the North Shore of the city of Chicago.
Yes.
And here's the second one. I don't think that Cuomo is going to win by 20 points. Cuomo has slipped
upset.
Someone.
No, it's not. I'm saying Cuomo is slipped on a banana peel.
On that subject, on the Sunday morning shows, one of the pundits had this to say. They said that the big winner for 2016 may not be a name that we've talked about. And there's been about a dozen names that we've talked about. And that the name that people will be talking about on Wednesday and Thursday and as the weeks and months go forward will be John Kasich, the incumbent governor of Ohio, who is expected to win by double digits. And he is a guy who's wanted to be president for a long time. He will have the record and he will have momentum. Your reaction, Mr. Lundy.
The Ohio Democratic candidate is a train wreck, absolute train wreck. My friends in Ohio on the Democratic side are just apoplectic over what an awful, awful. This guy makes Bruce Braley look like Bill Clinton.
Could it be that John Kasich is very good?
Well, Kasich has been to the school of hard knocks.
Yes, he has.
And he's a very tested and proven candidate, and he will be a major force in the presidential sweepstakes.
I totally agree, because what we all know is if you want to be president of the United States and you're a Republican, you had better win Ohio. Our thanks to Chris Roebling, who's going to be on WGN Radio on election night.
TV.
And also Dave Lundy, who's going to be on WBEZ. That's the public radio station in Chicago. Thank you all for being with us. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Dan Dorfman and Colin Bobbitt made this program possible. Until next week, when we will be back, we'll be analyzing all the winners, all the losers, talking about what it all means in the big, big picture. Until then, don't forget to vote. This is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.